in the Pacific, we have a third gender, and it sits between the binary of male and female, but it is a legitimate and recognized gender spectrum in my culture and has existed since the beginning of time.
My name is Hilde de Bruin. I'm the artistic director of Into Nature, a visual arts organization aimed at the public representation of innovative international contemporary visual art in and in relation to the landscape of the Dutch province of Drenthe. The premise is to connect international contemporary art, landscape and current social issues. Into Nature gained recognition for the realization of its recurring biennial, which takes place at a different location in the Drenthe landscape each time. Leading artists research, visualize, question and comment on the landscape for this biennial, often creating new work specific to the context and location. Today, we have the pleasure of hosting a conversation between interdisciplinary visual artist Tanu Gago and Jessica Dempsey, director of ASTRON, the Netherlands Institute for Radio Astronomy. We brought them together because of their shared interest in the arts, in inclusion, and in gathering knowledge about the universe. Also, Tanu presented one of his artworks during the last edition of our biennial, very close to the world's largest low-frequency telescope, which is built and managed by ASTRON. Welcome, Tanu, and welcome, Jessica. I'm so happy that you could join us today. Could both of you briefly introduce yourselves, perhaps starting with Tanu?
Firstly, thank you for having me here today. I really appreciate this opportunity to share space and have conversations. My name is Tanu Gago. I'm an interdisciplinary artist from Aotearoa, New Zealand. I was originally born in Samoa, which is a small island in the Pacific, and I migrated here as an infant. A lot of my practice is focused around migrations, specifically Pacific migration, and I guess what it means to be kind of culturally displaced and try to identify notions of home and belonging. And a lot of that is a journey as well with representation and I guess the politics of identity. I work in mostly digital mediums, so photography, some filmmaking, and then it's hard to define, but I would say virtual reality and augmented reality.
Thank you, Tanu. And I think your work is known, you're known for making work that highlights various aspects of Pacific culture before colonization and the influence of Western religions. At least the work that we showed in our biennial very much deals with these topics. We'll get to talk about that more later, I'm pretty sure. Jessica.
Thank you again. I like Tanu. Kia ora, Tanu. And kia ora, Hilde. It's good to be here. So yes, I'm speaking of migrants, I think I'm more of a random wanderer on the planet, and certainly I've only been here and fortunate enough to be in the Netherlands for about 18 months now, but originally from Australia. I grew up way out bush, and that was my first, you know, collective story in history, you know, in growing up in indigenous areas. But then my work as an astronomer, building telescopes took me as far down as Antarctica. And then I spent many years bouncing back and forth between New Zealand and Australia. I've been married a Maori artist from the Ruatoria area, Gisborne, and got to spend a lot of time there and start to sort of explore the spaces of Indigenous art. And then going to Hawaii, where I spent over a decade helping to run the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope. This was where I really started to come to a reckoning of what colonialization really meant. Looking at it from a lens of the Native Hawaiian protests against construction of the 30-meter telescope on Mauna Kea, was the first time someone who I, you know, been trying to speak, you know, three indigenous languages, trying to sort of really from my love of Indigenous art and mythology and space, now find myself on the wrong side of a conversation, or on the wrong side of a picket line, representing, you know, everything that I wanted to break down. So this was a real, reckoning moment for me, and one where I then started to reframe what ethics in astronomy means, because we think in astronomy we don't need to be ethical. We just look at the stars. And forgetting that the footprint of astronomy, like every science, is on land, and in particular astronomy now, it's on nearly 90% colonized land, 85% unclaimed indigenous land. And astronomy just doesn't have the language for this conversation. And so for me, I'm so... Also, I get tired of the separation of science and art. You know, in Indigenous storytelling, the story and the science are one. The story and the art is one. And I think we lose so much in science by separating them this way. And so seeing some of Tanu's art and the intersectional nature of it, for me, and especially right next to the telescopes, as it was, you know, this is a start to a new conversation.
Thanks, Jessica. That is a great introduction and very spot on in terms of the content for this conversation. So before we go into these topics more, perhaps it's best if we try to explain a little bit more about the work Atua that you showed in our biennial Tanu. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about it, because not all listeners of the podcast will have experienced the work.
So Atua is an augmented reality sculpture, and there is a physical component to the sculpture that is a light box, I guess, is the simplest way to describe it. This light box is adorned with cultural motifs that when paired with an iOS device, either iPhone or an iPad, activates a virtual story about an Atua. And so in my culture, Atua is referred to as our deities and our celestial ancestors. I currently operate as an artist, as I would say, like a survivor of a form of colonial erasure that has happened to the third gendered people of my culture. And in the Pacific, we have a third gender that is set, I guess, alongside a spectrum of gender. And it sits between the binary of male and female, but it is a legitimate and recognized gender spectrum in my culture, and has existed since the beginning of time. But due to the colonial program or the colonial agenda, a lot of that history has been erased from my culture, partly due to the stories that the first settler colonists decided to keep when they first arrived in the Pacific. And a lot of the stories that referenced anything that sat outside the kind of heteronormative understanding of gender and the binary of male, female was basically erased, and any artifacts were destroyed. And the stories that recorded that history were all burnt. And so for a long time, the thing that had replaced those stories was this kind of religious shame. And it was weaponized in a way that made our people conform into two gender spaces. And slowly over time, the third gender space started to shrink and disappear. And then even more problematically, in the 60s and 70s, we had anthropologists come to the Pacific and try to revitalize this kind of academic lens on third gender. But it was done in a very abstracted scientific exchange, where there was no real value exchange in terms of what stories were shared from third gender community with these anthropologists, and a lot of them built their careers on some of the stories that were collected from that region and published all kinds of interesting academic publications about gender and sexuality. And so, again, I feel like I come from a tradition or a grouping of people who experience a second wave of kind of mistreatment. I'm now part of a generation who, thankfully, through the way stories are told and shared within our genealogical familial lines, have been shared a version of that colonial violence that is a bit more honest about what happened. And I'm also part of a generation that is slowly reclaiming those stories and trying to figure out ways to tell them with authenticity and conviction without the kind of scientific anthropological gaze on our narratives and stories. And I'm just an artist who's interested with that interface or that intersection where cultural storytelling meets technology. Because in my mind, cultural storytelling is a form of technology. And it's something I find quite fascinating when it is trying to build a relationship with contemporary or modern technology in order to tell a story. And so that was the provocation for Atua. How can these two things arrive at one another? And what would they look like? And so in order to create this work, I drew from a lot of my cultural heritage. And it's a collaborative project with another Māori Indigenous artist here. And so the sculpture was built as a pō whenua, which is a land marking in Māori. It was built as a pō to guide our people and our audiences to the story. So a little bit like a lighthouse, like when you're lost at sea and you're trying to find your way home. The atua was this light sculpture that gave you a sense of direction. And if you were lost in Europe somewhere, that you might happen across it in a gallery. And when you were able to activate it, it unlocked all this knowledge and information for you. The way that the sculpture does this is that it generates a digital atua, which is a celestial body. And that atua's name is Te Kore. And Te Kore tells a creation story. It's a very short story. It's only like 4 minutes long. But it's a story from our history that, as I mentioned earlier, has kind of been erased from our textbooks and our cultural archives. And it's something, as artists, that I'm really interested in researching and restoring, and for no other reason than to give my own people back, give them back the missing pieces of their own stories. Sorry, that was a very long description of the work, but context is very important, so I hope that's helpful.
You already answered a lot of questions that I prepared for you, Tanu. Oh,
but I have so many more just from everything that Tanu is saying. I could pester you for hours, Tanu.
Oh, go ahead, Jessica.
I will firstly say, Tanu, I mean, I got the privilege of seeing the work in its field, and I can just, you know, add to that. Instead of it being an ocean, you know, it's a grass sea. And you sort of step down into this sort of footprint in the land, and there it's standing there, and it's and it's already a beautiful work before you connect, you know, to your phone and the iPad, and then Te Kore is there, and they're so confronting in that space. That was actually my first reaction was, oh wow, hi, and then of course he's got this magical voice I could listen to for hours. And then you get to be able to explore with him. I mean, the interactiveness of it was just, well, I'm going to enthuse a bit. It was just genius in the space, because once you start interacting with him or them, because this is the most important part that I want to bring up, that original sort of, oh, you know, confrontation goes away. At least it did for me. and then you can start to interact and you can explore it. And there's a level now where you can start to think about this in a much more abstract space as the story is being told. So that was sort of, for me, the first thing that jumped out. The question I have, you know, is Te Kore, I love the Māori mythologies of you know, your celestial ancestors. They're not as distant as in a lot of white, you know, cultural religions, right? And they've got far more human aspect. They've got far more, you know, connectivity. So I'd like to ask about Te Kore and the intersectional nature of the media that you use, because for me, that just seemed natural as a way to subvert those gaps in understanding.
Yes. I mean, Te Kore has never been depicted as a being before. in Māori custom, Te Kore is often referred to as a time and space. it's a concept of time and space that is kind of limitless and also a period of abundance for a lot of people. Atua, actually, when we first developed it, it was supposed to be part of a series. We had all these other deities like Tangaroa, the god of the ocean, and we had all these other ancestral deities that we wanted to talk about, but we knew we had to start in some type of chronology, that we couldn't just like shoot for our favorite ones that we like the most and start there. That if we were going to do it as a series, we had to have a start point, and Te Kore felt like the perfect place to start. And then when we thought about this kind of infinite space that reminded me of space and the stars and the universe and this kind of infinite idea, notion of abundance, it just reminded us of the internet and the kind of digital space that is created when we're, when artists are building, creating scaffolding in that space. It just felt like the proper synergy between the kind of digital space and this kind of abundant cultural space. And so we had identified in the chronology that we wanted to start somewhere at the beginning. And so Te Kore is a reflection on the beginning of the universe and the endlessness of it as well. It felt like the perfect place to start. We needed, I guess, a body or something embodied to create a human connection with the people experiencing the artwork and the users. And I find that quite interesting that that for us as humans to connect with something, that it needs to have a body and a face and an identity. So we kind of explored that curiosity for about a year to like figure out, well, what is Te Kore's body? And if this is a space of limitlessness, how do we refine something like that? And so, you know, I thought it was really important to collaborate with an artist who identifies as non-binary, because this is a question that they are experiencing every minute of the day. And I thought it was a lovely way to bring that feeling into the conversation without making it feel restrictive or something that people had to be afraid of, because it wasn't denominational. Like, we weren't saying it had to be one and two. We were saying it could be three, four, and five, and six, and any number of identities. And so with this open canvas, we created Te Kore, and we wanted people to be able to project their own experiences onto Te Kore. And so while Te Kore operates in this digital void and limitless cultural space, they also are not binary either. So they are, I guess, an extended example of limitlessness. I hope this is making sense and I don't sound strange. Yeah, because I guess this is the fun part aspect of the development of the work, was that we got to really play with these grand ideas and really explore, which was exciting as a queer artist, because a lot of our history is set in stone. Science fiction has opened up a new space for us to explore and to be the explorers without being colonizers, which I think is exciting for a lot of young artists. And so, yeah, after some of that gymnastics, we were able to, you know, really just pin down the aspects that we thought were important for the type of story we wanted to tell. When Te Kore appears, they can be quite jarring because they're life size and very animated, and there's a crack in the air when the virtual reality version emerges from this light box. It's like a genie being let out of a bottle a little bit, so it can come as quite a shock. But we wanted the experience to feel really intimate, and so there are really soft and tender moments in that story. And then there's really like angry kind of confrontational parts that are responding to this history of erasure and history of colonization that, you know, that Te Kore we imagine is a little bit petty about. Yeah, and we asked renowned New Zealand theatre drama actor Nathaniel Lees to be the voice of Te Kore. And that's mostly because we wanted to strike a balance between the voice and the physical body, which is a bit more feminine. So we were always straddling that notion of breaking the binary when we were creating the work. And so, yeah, that's the voice of Te Kore, and that's who you hear when you activate the experience. And I love Nathaniel Lees. The first time I saw Nathaniel Lees was in The Matrix, and it blew my mind. And I just thought, that's incredible to see an Indigenous person in that realm. And I guess it's inspired all of us as artists to think about our, you know, science fiction and our Indigenous stories and what they look like in the future or could look like in the future. So it was a real full circle moment for me. So when they agreed to come and be the voice of Te Kore.
I would like to jump back to what you said earlier, because you said you interacted with the work. But how did you do that?
So the ability to be able to walk around the light post, and actually you're now seeing this figure in the air, but you're now seeing it from the side. Now you're seeing it from behind. The manifestation of it, even though you're looking at a screen, is entirely three-dimensional in the space that you're in. And we actually, it was quite interesting because Te Kore followed us, because we reenacted it when we were further away from the light post, and now we were in the trees, and there they were again. And so you can move around the figure as it's giving the story to you, and that's just an extraordinary thing to do. I've done this before in galleries, but to have that in an open space, right, to have it open to the sky especially, because that's what you're talking about, was it was just magical. And so for me, you know, it was a tremendously immersive experience. And I think, you know, Tanu, with the part you said about it, there being tender moments, you know, after the little shock of it appearing, it is very intimate, I think, and everyone who's there or using a device gets to choose how they interact with it. And I think that ability to choose is something that I'm interested in giving that opportunity, especially when you're exploring queer space, especially when you're exploring that lost choice or lost choice modes, especially for Indigenous cultures which have been colonized, that being able to make those choices safely again, and in an appropriate cultural context, right? Your own cultural context. I think that's a really important part of the experience that I at least really reflected, I enjoyed.
Thank you. That means a lot.
I came across an article by a professor, Hilding Nielsen. I don't know if he's very well known in your field, but he speaks of astro-colonialism. But he also brings up the idea that that indigenous knowledge about the sky could be integrated more in Western education about astronomy. Is that something that you, as a director of Astron, that you could actively advocate if you wanted to, or are there any attempts to actually do so in the world? Or
I mean, there are pockets of this, not in astronomy per se, because there's still an awful lot of defensiveness in Western science to indigenous ways of knowing. And it's part of the, it's part and parcel of the ivory tower, because you've just built all of this importance up to say this is the only way to find truth. And so you have to, by doing that, therefore eradicate the legitimacy of another way of knowing, of another way of finding truth. And so indigenous methodologies will be rejected by Western science up until now because of that conceit. Whereas to me, and especially, I mean, the single best navigators on the planet were the ones who colonized the Pacific. And this, the navigational knowledge alone, is it's naive to think that's where it stopped. The indigenous and Polynesian and Aboriginal and sort of Australian First Peoples knowledge of the stars goes beyond nearly any Western astronomer I know, because you can't just look up there and look at these objects. They're not objects in indigenous culture. They're family. And they're your livelihood, and they're your way of understanding the world. And there's no distinction between the two. So I actually find indigenous methodologies and indigenous astronomy to be far more instinctive and far more thorough than the way we go about it in Western science. So an example, I mean, I I'm very most familiar with Maori stories, creation stories, and stellar ones, and of course Native Hawaiian ones from my work there. But one of the ones I was very fortunate to be a part of, the Event Horizon Telescope team that imaged a black hole, or two of them now. And we were really blessed to have Uncle Larry Kimura, who's a professor of Hawaiian language studies in Hilo, gift a name, Povehi, to that first black hole image. And it wasn't until we started to go and unpack the Kumulipo, the Native Hawaiian creation chant, there's 200 descriptions of po, darkness. There's this obsession, especially in the starting creation description of the universe, of these descriptions of po. The first 20 lines essentially describe the Big Bang. And I'm like, how did Native Hawaiians know about black holes? Because that's the level of description that comes out in these creation charts. Indigenous Aboriginals were some of the first to track binary stars. This knowledge is already there, and they're in the stories. And they're in some of the stories that Tanu's saying, you know, have been eradicated. A lot of this has been lost. And so for me, lifting up the voice and the stories and making sure we don't just preserve them, but we breathe life back into them. Because I honestly, Western scientists could use a little bit of imagination, if you ask me. And the other part is, I think we lose a lot of our connectivity with people and our community by not being able to tell a story, and not being able to connect whatever this knowledge is to a way of people for understanding it. So for me, that indigenous knowledge never tried to separate those two things. So I think it can enhance our current Western methods. And I really reject this sort of our way or the highway idea in Western science, because I think it does a detriment to us. And I think it's immoral, especially when you are standing on native soil, to do this kind of work.
So Tanu, I wondered, how did you get hold of all this information that that is part of the artwork? Because it's an app. We see Te Kore appear, but there are also other parts in the app where the visitor, the user of it, can gain a lot of information about the cultural context of the work, as well as the meaning of the various symbols that appear on the sculpture as well as on Te Kore's body.
Well, yeah, I mean, just to reiterate the importance of the stars in the Pacific and recognizing that they are our family, because we have names for them. And I mean, this is ultimately what sits within the kind of Pacific knowledge systems, is that if we have a name for it, then it is something that is relevant to our cultural experience.
Was this knowledge easily available still, the knowledge that you passed down in your artwork, or was it hard to get by, to get hold of?
So some of it is recorded in our through text, and we have a few publications around the meaning or the significance of those markings, but a lot of them just come from lived experience because we have those markings on our body and those things are like passed down. And in the Samoan culture, there is a specific tattoo that uses star constellations and it's a motif that has existed for thousands of years. And like my grandparents have those markings on their bodies. And so the ones that we designed for Te Kore, they all come from a place of like family origin. And so there were four designers that worked on Te Kore's marking. So it was myself, and a Samoan artist named Pati Tai Rau, and a Māori Takatāpui artist named Jamie Waititi, and then, of course, Jermaine Dean. And so we brought all our family familial knowledge together and our kind of understanding of our cosmology and developed like a language, I guess, of symbols that we wanted to reference. And part of that was restoring some queer symbology. So there's even like, we tried to put a rainbow in there, but using like Pacific motifs so that it wasn't so literal. And again, this is the sandbox that a lot of artists are getting to play in, where they get to redefine what these symbols mean. A lot of what we try to do in that sandpit is, how can we take things that are given to us that are not ours and change those things, alter those symbols using our own cultural knowledge and practice to reclaim what is taken away from us. And so there's this huge reclamation with every, I guess, artistic experiment that most of my generation are attempting to do, is reclaim old knowledge systems, reclaim old languages and symbols, and also create new ones. So creating new ones so that we can imagine a future, a future outside of these like disparity statistics and these kind of sad and depressing like statistical realities for our queer Indigenous people specifically. The Cook Islands recently had repealed some of the anti-queer legislation earlier this year. So now they recognize their gender and people can get married in the Pacific, and it's no longer legal in the Cook Islands for you to be a queer person. But that still has yet to happen for the majority of the other countries, like the Samoa, where I come from, Tonga and Niue and so many other Pacific nations. And so I think the kind of astrological knowledge is one context, but we didn't want to reproduce that knowledge, that Western astrological knowledge. We wanted to mirror it with something that was rooted in our own cultural reality. And so a lot of those motifs are using a hybrid of altered symbols from queer history and altered symbols from our Māori and Samoan Pacific Island history as well. And I think that's just a sign of the conditions of how it's made. It kind of reflects the interests of where the diaspora artists are kind of exploring. It's quite interesting that Te Kore has markings, because it almost makes Te Kore an Indigenous person, because it's like restoring the markings onto the body. Yeah, these were quite abstract when we were working on this project, and with future iterations of the sculpture and the atua, it's probably going to get even more complex and a little bit deeper. I mean, we'll probably spend a lot a time talking about it.
I didn't realize that you really actually combined different cultural symbols and appropriate these in that way.
You're talking about reclaiming, you know, lots of space at the same time, right? You know, in the intersectional nature of you know, your representation, who you identify as, both in terms of a colonized culture or a series of colonized cultures, and then of course in the queer space and in the, you know, the gender identification space. And so for me, the interesting part about Te Koru as a choice is, you know, that they are a representation of chaos. And so I sort of wanted to unpack that with you a little bit, because again, coming back to an astronomical motif, you know, everything comes out of a big bang, right? Chaos is a force of creation. And yet in a Western context, chaos is a negative, you know, concept. But I didn't personally get that from the work, and so I don't want to put words in your mouth, because I just want to lead you to this idea of Te Koru and chaos, you know, standing at the sort of vortex of all of these conflicting, you know, and challenging spaces that you guys are trying to reclaim. Is that a burden? You know, does that feel like a burden, or does that feel like a more of a challenge space, you know, and that place you guys want to be at, because, you know, that's where it's at?
I thank you for your question, and I feel like burden is an interesting thing, because most of our Pacific cultures are cultures of service. And so, like, it's hard to, because even that is a Western idea, like most of our cultural protocols are built on service. And so, yeah, it's hard to imagine that, I guess, that I wouldn't burden myself with a little responsibility to, if I knew that there was a greater good or a greater benefit for our people specifically. And I guess just talking to the chaos aspect of Te Koru, that is one of the main things that drew us to Te Koru, was just how crazy it could get. And how crazy it does get in some of our stories. Like, it gets a bit wild. We always thought about this idea of even control being a Western thing, like the idea that we are, our responsibility on this earth is to dominate and control everything. Yeah, and so we started to think about the chaos as like this way of breaking out of these kind of neuroses that we have about mortality and this idea of no longer existing, that actually there is a continuation, and if we don't occupy this time and space, we still will occupy another, like whatever remains will still occupy another time and space. And so, like, I thought about, yeah, just this need that we had to define everything from our gender, from our social status. And I think this is what we loved the most about Te Koru, was the freedom to not designate, to not define, to let go of control, to let go of our kind of struggle with mortality. And the idea that that is ultimately what is driving us to attempt to dominate everything in the world, and it's this very masculine experience. And even that, like, just letting go of masculinity, I think that was the exciting part of the project. But yeah, I think as a digital experience, we still, our producers were like, okay, that's great, so let's put that in a container and try and shape it and give it some form. And yeah, I mean, I feel so vague when I describe these things, but this is honestly what the experience of creating Te Koru was like. Like, we just, that thing of choice, we didn't always have the opportunity to explore these spaces and these ideas. And like I said before, we could just keep going and going. We found ourselves for the first time in our careers and in our practices being able to speculate and to ideate and to think of a different universe outside of the one that we see being built in front of us through corporations. And there's this line from a Chuck Palahniuk book where he says it'll be the corporations that colonize space. And that's always been stuck with me. And I find it quite cynical and pessimistic. And I just think, no, there has to be an optimistic view about these things that is contrary to that kind of total pessimism. We tried to play in that space when we were making Te Kore, and I love what came out, and I'm really excited to keep working on and developing this series and seeing what other experimental spaces we can play in.
Thank you so much, Tanu, and thank you, Jessica. Thank you for a wonderful conversation, and thanks to our listeners for listening.
Thank you, Jessica, and thank you, Hilda. It was it's really lovely to talk about this with people. I just wanted to express my gratitude and say thank you so much.